Good morning, Your Honors. Eric Sandler, attorney registration number 32349 on behalf of Mr. Phillips. I think a good starting point today is the third question that this court had asked us to brief, and that's because obviously if I do not prevail on that issue, the question whether or not the statements were testimonial does not really matter, as the child would have testified, and whether or not it was harmless error would not have mattered either. So that's where I think I'll start. First, I would like to directly address the arguments raised by the people in both their supplemental brief and in their answer. The people relied on four cases, and they seem to conclude that this issue has already been decided by the Colorado Supreme Court. That is simply not true. All of the cases they've cited to deal with the issue of whether or not whether or not the admission of that hearsay violates the Confrontation Clause. The issue here, however, is not whether the face-to-face language of Article 2, Section 16 provides greater protection against hearsay than the Sixth Amendment. Rather, the issue is whether is the manner in which Mr. Phillips is entitled to exercise this fundamental right of confrontation. More particularly, the question is whether Article 2, Section 16 sets forth specific procedures to be followed in the presentation of testimony. The Massachusetts courts in Commonwealth v. Welton recognize this because, as the court knows, Massachusetts has interpreted its constitutional provision, which is the exact same language as ours, to require a face-to-face, but they've also stated that even though they have held that their Confrontation Clause doesn't provide any greater rights with regard to hearsay than the federal constitution, it provides greater rights with regard to how that procedure is to take place. While I'm not certainly not conceding that Article 2, Section 16 does not provide greater protection against the admission of hearsays, that issue is just not before the court. I'm just trying to make that it's two separate and distinct issues, and that's how it needs to be approached.
Mr. Sandler, can you remind us how the Massachusetts court squares this? I mean, you can understand the logic of the people's argument, which is to say, if the Constitution absolutely guarantees face-to-face confrontation, then it would seemingly preclude the admission of hearsay. So can you tell us how the Massachusetts court sort of squared that?
Well, it wouldn't necessarily preclude the admission of hearsay, because if you look at the federal law, especially after Crawford, the only hearsay that implicates the Confrontation Clause, as far as the federal courts are concerned, is testimonial hearsay.
So the Crawford development sort of retroactively, reconciles the two principles. I mean, so in other words, all the Colorado pronouncements that there's a preference for face-to-face, but it doesn't preclude the admission of hearsay.
Well, there's never been an analysis I can see in any of the Colorado cases under Article 2, Section 16. They all simply cite to the federal constitution and say that under the federal constitution, there's a preference. But the whole logic behind Maryland v. Craig, for example, was premised on the fact that, well, if we do this, and what I kind of call the Chicken Little argument, is that if we do this, then there's no such thing as hearsay anymore.
Well, Mr. Sandler, let me ask about the Craig opinion. Is that still good? I mean, it hasn't reached the U.S. Supreme Court yet, but given Crawford and the direction it's going.
Is it still good? Well, obviously it's still good at this point in time because it's not.
Well, I understand that, but
the logic behind it, and is I don't think it's there anymore, and I think that once you look at Crawford, especially look at the fact, if you look at Scalia's dissent, which is basically just almost a mirror image of what his opinion was in Crawford, it's questionable at best whether or not Maryland v. Craig is still good law, as it's premised on the fact that, well, if we do this, then aren't we basically doing away with all of hearsay.
Can we employ constitutional harmless error under face-to-face? Let's assume for the sake of argument we agree with you.
Okay.
Is the error constitutionally harmless as to both convictions?
As to both convictions, I don't believe it does, because then two things come into play then. First of all, the question comes into whether or not the statements to Ms. Ellis were admissible, whether or not they're testimonial, and obviously if they're testimonial, they don't come in. Period. And if they don't come in, then the question of whether or not, with regard at least to the first degree murder conviction, that's the evidence that supports the first degree murder conviction. That's the evidence that is the after deliberation fact, is the testimony of the child and the testimony, the statements that he made to Miss Ellis. So I don't think it can be harmless. And even if you want to look at it another way, I think it might be structural error, because one thing what we have here is that we have the child testifying via the closed circuit television, and as you know, his effect upon the jury, you know, is dependent upon a number of things. It's dependent upon how that's filmed, the angle taken. You know, I think that if the whole reason behind having a face-to-face confrontation is for the jury to be able to actually view the witness and view the reactions of the witness and view whether or not the witness is looking this way for answers or that way for answers, which you just simply cannot see when that's happening.
Are there cases to suggest, at least under state law, that this would be structural error?
You know, the three state cases that I've found in other jurisdictions, they did not make that delineation of structural error or harmless error. But I think under the Bergstrom analysis, if you look at it and the way they set forth about the effects that it had, it's almost as if, and even though they didn't say it was structural error, they didn't go through a harmless error analysis either. They didn't say that, well, if this didn't come in, then this would have happened. They simply said, well, this is the effect it had, and this is why we have it. And it's almost as if they were saying that this is a procedural aspect of the trial that was different. You can't change that.
But let me come back to your comment. Mm-hmm. Now, Ms. Ellis is Dominic's therapist, correct? Mm-hmm. Okay. Was a confrontation issue preserved below concerning her testimony as contrasted with, you know, objection merely on hearsay grounds?
You know, I believe it was. I would have to obviously go back and look at that, but I believe that that issue was raised. I believe that motion was filed, but I could be mistaken on that.
Okay, let's assume just for purposes of discussion that we agree with you on the closed circuit TV.
Okay.
So we take out all of Dominic's direct testimony.
Okay.
We disagree with you because unpreserved, whatever, and let in his hearsay statements through the therapist. Why isn't at that point it constitutional harmless error because of the extraordinary overlap between his testimony via closed circuit TV and his statements as repeated to the jury by the therapist?
Well, so what you're saying is that if it's non-testimony, if you're assuming that it's not his statements to...
I'm not asking you to give away anything. I'm just saying let's assume that that's the way we rule, that you win on the closed circuit TV, you lose on whatever objections were preserved as to the therapist's testimony. Why doesn't the similarity between those two lead to a constitutional harmless beyond a reasonable doubt conclusion?
Well, I think what it goes back to is that there's always the effect the child has just about upon his mere presence of being there. And I think
being in the court.
No, not being in the court, but the way that his testimony was presented is what I'm saying, is that they could not observe certain other things with regard to that might have influenced their decision differently with regard to credibility of the child. And if that's impacted, then what you have is if the child's credibility is impacted, then his statements with regard to what he said to Ms. Ellis, whether or not those were true or not, is impacted as well.
Is that the, trying to think way back, Davis versus Alaska? Isn't that what the old U.S. Supreme Court holdings in this area dealt with? The impact of effectively discrediting a witness could have on the whole trial, and the U.S. Supreme Court has rejected that.
Well, they have, but what we had there was, in one cannot say that in Davis v. Alaska, the witness was present, and if there was a witness, if I'm remembering correctly, there was a limitation on cross-examination, but the witness was still present in the courtroom, and the jury still had that opportunity to observe the witness unfettered by the television, rather than just observing a television screen. And obviously, when you observe a witness through a television screen, the difference being that what you have is that you can't really judge credibility, because it's all dependent upon A, the quality of the equipment, B, the angle taken with regard to whether or not, you know, whether chosen. You can't judge whether or not the child is looking this way or that way for answers. There's nothing to judge for that matter. So even if an objection was made with regard to that, how can the judge make a determination of whether or not, if an objection was made, whether or not that was happening. You also have the impact, I think, on cross-examination in and of itself when that sort of situation happens. And it may not be in this case, per se, because there were two attorneys, but in the normal situation where you have one attorney in there and you have the client separate, that's going to impact the ability to do cross-examination. Even if there is some sort of landline or however it is, there's going to be some delay in doing the cross-examination.
What extent can we review any of those issues de novo by looking at the video ourselves, analogizing to statements of our Supreme Court that we review de novo videotape interrogation?
Well, I think you can. I think there's no reason why you can't. The video's there for your observation.
Okay, suppose we look at the video and conclude that there's absolutely nothing in there that's untoward, nothing that would significantly impact the jury other than the actual content of the testimony, no suggestions of coaching, etc. That would then get me back to my harmless error question.
Well, I don't know if you can make that determination by looking at it, because again, what you have is that you can look at the video and you can say, well, is the child, because you can't tell from looking at the video. However you look at the video, you can't tell certain things about the child. You can't tell perhaps face color. You can't tell whether or not there. You can tell hesitation perhaps, but there's lots of things you can't tell from a video and how that would impact a jury. And how that would impact the fact finder on credibility.
I guess my question though is, can we decide that by looking at the video? I mean, you've made some statements. Well, suppose we look at the video and come to the opposite conclusion.
Well, then I think you're usurping the function of the jury. It's one thing to look at a video when you're talking about whether or not a statement was voluntary or not, because that's a legal question that the court decides. It's something else in its entirety to how that would impact a jury, which is a nebulous thing at best of how you can possibly do that. And since I never save any time for Ricardo, I would like to save the remaining time. Thank you.
May I please the court and counsel? Paul Kaler, for the people in this case, 19210. This is obviously not a structural error problem. Structural error has to do with the structure of the trial, biased judge, attorney conflict problems, improperly chosen and jury. This is just an evidentiary problem which can be addressed if there is any error under just sort of standard evidentiary harmless beyond a reasonable doubt questions.
Well, then could you address whether with a harmless question, the constitutional harmless question, assuming for the sake of argument that face-to-face means what it says, something different than what the U.S. Constitution says?
Sure, Your Honor. I don't think I'm being too bold about this. I think you could probably find it inadmissible every statement made by both boys and still find the errors harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
As to both?
I think you could nuke every statement by both boys, and we would still have any error would meet the constitutional beyond. It would be not constitutional error, and that's because the evidence of Chandler's death, that he was starved to death over a period of weeks, the condition of his body, the fact that it was pretty much could not be contested that he had been imprisoned in that little closet and he'd with his feces and the coverings and his fingerprints. The facts of the modifications both to the refrigerator and to the closet door to make sure that they could not be opened by a child, only by an adult. The statements that the defendant made at the time that he had been eating and drinking and walking were close to being incredible as a matter of law, as far as there being, two cubic centimeters of liquid found in his bladder, complete wasting away of his muscles, the fact that the defendant and his girlfriend or whatever she was were the adults in charge of that house. I think you could nuke almost every statement in this case and still affirm the conviction in this case because any error would be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. But
would you address then, particularly, Mr. Kaler, the evidence that would support the elements of intent and after? No, it's extremely different murder in this case.
I believe so, Your Honor.
Okay, so just let's focus on just what establishes the culpability necessary for the first degree murder conviction, because it seems to me your arguments make sense as it relates to child abuse resulting in death.
Yeah, the state of the child's body, it was clear from the medical testimony that this child had not eaten in a matter of weeks, and that he had been defecating on himself. He had bed sores all over his body. He was filthy. That evidence could only support a finding that the defendant knowingly or even intentionally intended that this child die as a result of starvation. But I think, too, I think most of these, I think these statements were all fine. The easiest way of addressing the statements to Ms. Ellis is what Crawford says itself. There's no confrontation clause, or the federal confrontation clause does not care if it takes no position on whether if a witness or a declarant testifies, as Dominic did, the confrontation clause problem does not exist. He was there for being confronted.
That assumes, though, that you win the closed circuit TV argument.
Right, Your Honor. Yeah, if the closed circuit TV is okay, then obviously there's no confrontation clause problem, and we just get into straight evidentiary questions as far as whether statements made to a therapist by a small child during therapy fall under the medical exception to the hearsay rule. I think clearly that is. I don't think that's frighteningly controversial. As far as the closed circuit TV question, I think, at least every case I found concerning the Colorado Supreme Court talking about differences between the federal confrontation clause issue and the Colorado Constitution clause, is they've always tried to maintain the same analysis between the two. Bastardo says, talking about the purposes of the two confrontation clauses, the purposes are the same. Compton, Dement, Blecka, and Newbro all have the Colorado Supreme Court addressing coverage under the Colorado and the federal confrontation clause as identical in scope.
Well, then, could I, sorry to interrupt.
Sure, Your
Honor. I'll go back to Maryland v. Craig. It's certainly still good law, but would you agree that it is on shaky ground post-Crawford?
I don't know. I think it's... It doesn't have anything to do with testimonial hearsay, I don't think, right? And the question, you know, are there something that constitutes testimonial hearsay, whether it occurred in a prior judicial proceeding, some sort of ex parte proceeding, whether it occurred during a course of police interrogations, all the different categories of testimony that becomes testimonial hearsay. I don't think it falls under that.
There was a Scalia dissent, right, in Craig.
Sure,
emphasizing face-to-face, the importance of face-to-face in a jury context.
Sure.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Right. Well, the Supreme Court itself has said, I think, a couple of times, but they get kind of cranky. Agostini versus Felton is the one I tend to use, where he says lower court should not read into this court's case law overruling of other decisions.
I understand all that, the legal status. I'm just thinking you're drawing a parallel between federal and state.
Yeah, Maryland versus Craig is still good law, and I think that's the law this court has to apply, unless it goes the big step of finding that the difference in language justifies a difference result.
And there is a clear difference.
Oh yeah.
I mean, face to face, the at the time it was adopted, they could have adopted the same language as the U.S.
Sure, Your Honor.
So, I mean. Well, do we ignore that?
Okay, well, let me point the court to two different cases, Colorado Supreme Court cases. First is Dement, which concerns the excited utterance hearsay exception. And the Colorado Supreme Court used the same language that the U.S. Supreme Court used in Maryland versus Craig, that taking the argument to its logical extreme, that face-to-face means literal face-to-face each time, the Colorado Supreme Court said that would mean that all of our hearsay exceptions and non-hearsay would go out the window, and it explicitly rejected that argument in Dement itself. So I think...
Well, Scalia didn't take that position in Crawford. So I'm not sure that logic flies, at least under the U.S. Supreme Court precedent. Does it?
No, but in Maryland versus Craig, that they took that argument. I don't know if they.
I'm talking about Crawford. I'm talking about Crawford in particular.
Yeah, I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know how to address that question.
Your point here is that the language in dement evidences the Colorado Supreme Court's awareness of and rejection of the face-to-face
argument,
absolute face-to-face guarantee, because it said if we adopted that, borrowing from Maryland against Craig, if that were true, then the hearsay stuff would fall. Yes, now, I asked Mr. Samla, and I'd ask you the same question. Obviously, other courts in other states, which have language identical to the Colorado Constitution, have found an additional guarantee under the state constitutions. Can you tell me how they addressed this tension, this apparent tension between the in-court procedures under the absolute face-to-face guarantee and the hearsay problem?
I don't know. I've read those cases many times, and I'm not sure how the result is different, how they have been able to keep their other hearsay exceptions while requiring an absolute face-to-face guarantee in this particular situation. I think another Colorado Supreme Court case, which I think is helpful, is Newbro. In that case, it involved video deposition testimony, a child witness in a case. And in that particular case, we have a much more extreme situation than we do here. In there, the therapist was with the declarant or with the witness by the child's self. And the attorneys were feeding questions to the therapist. Both sets of attorneys were feeding questions to the therapist in order for her to ask the questions to the child to get the testimony out. The Colorado Supreme Court found that constitutional under the Colorado Constitution. And I think that's much more of a stronger situation than what we have here, where the attorneys were able to ask the questions directly.
Was the defendant present, or did he have opportunity?
I don't think he was present at all, Your Honor. Was the fact of his absence argued?
Yeah.
I'm not sure that Newbro talks about that. In this particular case, of course, the trial court gave an instruction to the jury that directed the jury away from considering that the reason the child wasn't testifying was because of the defendant. It protected the defendant's right to a fair trial by saying it was a different cause than the trauma that the psychologist found the child would suffer here. So I guess that also, of course, this court twice has held that these procedures were constitutional, both in Mosley and in Rodriguez, that this protects the defendant's confrontation clause rights. The language from Mosley is, the statute represents, quote, as to how best and under what circumstances to accommodate the public's interest in protecting child's sex assault victims consistent with a defendant's right to face-to-face confrontation of adverse witnesses. So obviously, and I wouldn't make any argument that this is not the second best procedure. Obviously, the first best procedure would be always have every witness testifying live in front of the jury, in front of the defendant in the courtroom. But in this particular case, where we have a child concerning which the evidence was that he would suffer severe trauma as a result of testifying in front of the defendant at trial. This is a very extreme situation. This is a narrowly tailored remedy. My watching of the videotape is that the trial court and the prosecution went to great extents to make sure that, the jury was able to fully evaluate the child's testimony. They had the child speak up. They had him sit on some law books so that the jury could see his demeanor carefully. This was an extreme situation. The statute addresses extreme situations like this, and the trial court and the prosecution made this work so that the defendant could have a fair trial by having the jury evaluate Dominic's testimony fully as he spoke. And even if Dominic's testimony, the CCTV testimony does go away, we still have his statements to the therapist. Ms. Ellis, they would either come in as statements during the course of medical treatment, as prior consistent statements, as prior inconsistent statements. And I think, too, I know we, under the child hearsay statute, that it only functions where the statements are not admissible otherwise. It also falls under that. The trial court only found four of the grounds. I count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I count six of the concerns or six of the factors that we've been instructed to consider in determining the admission of child hearsay. I think they fit there, too. So I'm almost out of time. Does the court have any other questions I could try and address? Thank you very much, Your Honors. And just on behalf of my colleagues, and I'd like to thank the court for the order directing the issues to be considered during oral argument. I think that helps our preparation and helps us not waste time. Thank you very much.
I would like to first address a few of the cases talked about. I can first talk about the People v. Rodriguez case, since I am very, very familiar with that case since I was involved in it. In People v. Rodriguez, they did not address whatsoever the state constitution. That issue was not raised down below, and but the Court of Appeals, which was affirmed by operation of law after a split Supreme Court, basically said that because it was not raised down below, we're just going to address it under the federal constitution. So that has nothing to do with here or there. I don't believe Mosley at all addressed the issue with regard to the state constitution. And with regard to Libro, the parties agreed down below to the procedures used. And the court said that, well, if you agree to it, you can't come back and say that it's a violation of the Confrontation Clause, which only makes sense. So I don't think either of those cases have anything to do or support the people's position whatsoever. I think the bottom line is this, is when this court or any court does any sort of constitutional analysis, the first thing the court must do is to look at what the words say. And if the words say what the words say, and if there's no absurdity there, and they have to be given effect. Otherwise, what this court is really doing is simply amending the constitution, by judicial fiat.
What about demand?
With regard to
the demand court's reference to Craig and suggestion that taking a broader view of confrontation would essentially take out all hearsay.
No, because I think they're two separate issues. I think here what we're talking about is a procedural issue. The first question is always, it's always going to be, does the defendant have the right of confrontation? And then what we need to look at, if we look at a Crawford analysis and say the right only applies under testimonial statements, and then the only hearsay under Crawford which is admissible possibly is a dying declaration, and even then I'm not so sure it is, since in Michigan v. Brunnett they went out of their way in their tortured logic to find that it was non-testimonial rather than it being a dying declaration. So if under that, or at least under a Crawford analysis, if it's non-testimonial, then there's not a right of confrontation. I don't think that issue needs to be reached, because that's the first and initial issue here is when the testimony is presented, as here, is there a right? So clearly.
Okay, let me just be sure I understand. So what you're saying is that even if we take a literalist view of face-to-face, mm-hmm. it still would only apply to testimonial.
I'm not necessarily saying it, but what I'm saying in this situation, and in the situation where the witness testifies, this is how the witness has to testify. These are the procedures that have to follow. If there's a right to confront them, then this is the procedures that have to be followed. So if the court wants to analyze when the right of confrontation is there, then we need to do that first. But once there's a right, certainly in this situation, it can't be denied that Mr. Phillips had a right of confrontation in this case. And then the question becomes, how is that right fulfilled? And I see that I'm out of time.
Brian, I'm going to keep you up for one more second, if it's okay.
Sure.
I mean, I understand your argument, Mr. Semler. And I got to say that if we were here deciding the issue tabula rasa, mm-hmm. without anybody's additional guidance, your argument would be quite strong. You have very strong textual support for your position. But, of course, this is an intermediate appellate court. We have to get our clues from what the Colorado Supreme Court does. You know, they've been aware since the 90s of this videotape procedure and aware of the additional protections potentially guaranteed under the Colorado Constitution. And yet we've had no hint from that court that the videotape procedures are unconstitutional. And indeed, in dement, as Mr. Keeler points out, they seem to be aware of the dangers of promulgating an absolute face-to-face guarantee. So my question to you is, what's your advice? What do we do here? Just take a bold stab and say this is what the Constitution requires, even though we've had no suggestion at all from the Colorado Supreme Court that that's the direction they're going to go?
I don't see this question ever being decided by either the Supreme Court. You know, I have done extensive research on this. I did extensive research on this with regard when I did People v. Rodriguez. And I could not find this issue being directly addressed by either this court or by the Colorado Supreme Court, or the argument being raised under Article 2, Section 16 with regard to face-to-face. Any of that analysis always seemed to go back to the Sixth Amendment. And it was simple Sixth Amendment analysis. There was no analysis under Article 2, Section 16. If this is what it said, this is what our Constitution says, this is how it is different than the federal Constitution. In fact, Article 2, Section 16 even guarantees the right to appear in person, which is not in the Sixth Amendment whatsoever. I haven't seen that argument made anywhere either, that's different with regard to the defendant's right to appear in person.
Oh, thank you for that answer. Thank you both for appearing in this special session. I know that's a whole bunch of extra work, but this is a complicated case, and we appreciate your arguments.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I echo that view. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. A written opinion will issue in due course when the table